Good afternoon. Welcome to the 408th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, the president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. Many of our members have considerable foreign affairs experience in government and with corporations and private organizations. Our membership also includes writers, physicians, educators, journalists, lawyers, business people, and people from many other professions seeking to stay informed on international issues. The Forum is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum extends a warm welcome today to Professor Dominic Tierney, who will be speaking on America in an Era of Unwinnable Wars. Dr. Tierney is an associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and a contributing writer to The Atlantic magazine. After receiving his PhD in international politics from Oxford University in 2003, Dr. Tierney was a postdoctoral fellow at Ohio State University and at Harvard University before joining the political science department at Swarthmore in 2005. During the 2008-2009 academic year, he was a research fellow at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, in various academic journals, and on national public radio. He has published 4 books on diplomatic history and on the American way of war. His first book, Failing to Win, Perceptions of Victory and Defeat in International Politics, won the International Studies Association Award for the best book published in 2006. His latest book, published by Little, Brown, and Company in 2015, is The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. Dominic, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you so much for that graceful and overly kind introduction. It's really been wonderful to come and visit the Camden area. This is my first time north of Portland, Maine. And I'm sure it will not be my last trip, having seen some of the beautiful scenery you guys get to enjoy. So I'm going to talk about some themes in my latest book, The Right Way to Lose a War. And I'm also going to bring it up to date by thinking about the Trump administration and where we are today in the Middle East and elsewhere. So we live in an era of seemingly endless quagmires, really going back decades. Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. So why has America stopped winning wars? Can we return to the path of victory? This is not an easy topic for Americans to think about. After all, the United States is a victory culture. Consider that Americans spend every year $3 billion just on trophies. And General Douglas MacArthur famously said, "There is no substitute for victory." Trump actually tweeted out that quote a couple years ago. But understanding failure, although challenging, is critical, not just for the lives of American soldiers, but also for the future of countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, for America's reputation and global image, for domestic politics here in the United States, for the careers of presidents. And in fact, failure can be, if handled correctly, an opportunity. Losing is a gift that can spur badly needed change. We all learn by failure. For instance, it turns out that baseball teams that do poorly in one season tend to adapt more effectively and improve the next season, while teams that do well tend to become complacent. You've probably seen the same thing in the business world, for example. So in the same vein, the searing experience of loss in wartime could help the U.S. military learn, reform, and emerge stronger than before. So for a century, up until the end of World War II in 1945, The United States won virtually every major military campaign that it fought against Mexico, the Confederacy, Spain, Germany, Japan. And then all of a sudden, we stopped winning wars as we entered an era of unwinnable conflict where decisive victory has often proved to be a pipe dream. The Korean War back in the 50s was a grim stalemate at the cost of 37,000 American lives. In Vietnam, the United States faced outright military defeat for the first time in its history. And most shockingly, it was against North Vietnam, which LBJ described as a, quote, raggedy-ass little fourth-rate country. The British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, Prime Minister in the 60s, once said that the golden rule of politics is, quote, never invade Afghanistan. Nevertheless, in 2001, the United States swaggered into this harsh and beautiful land. And within 2 months, the Taliban had been routed from Kabul, retreated south towards the Pakistan border. But the war was not over. The Taliban recovered, escalated their attacks, and today, 17 years later, we are stuck in a stalemated conflict. An even bleaker tale played out in Iraq, where the overthrow of Saddam Hussein's government triggered the collapse of civil order and widespread unrest, looting, and eventually a very bloody insurgency. So during the last 7 decades, the Gulf War in 1991 stands out as the only clear American success in major war. So in terms of victory, we are 1 for 5. We live in an era of protracted conflict. The 3 longest wars in American history were Afghanistan, Iraq, and Vietnam. Or think about what the most resonant images of conflict are from the last few decades. Are they glorious scenes of victory? Or are they helicopters rescuing people from rooftops in Saigon? Or naked bodies intertwined at Abu Ghraib in Iraq? So why does the United States struggle on the battlefield? Why do we go so dramatically from winning virtually every war to winning virtually no wars? Well, the answer is a combination of American power and a changed battlefield environment. So after 1945, the United States bestrode the world like a colossus, as the unsurpassed superpower. But America's newfound strength created a constant temptation to use force, projecting American soldiers into distant conflicts. Washington chose an unfortunate moment to discover its inner interventionist, because the nature of warfare changed after 1945 from conflicts between countries, in other words, interstate wars, to conflicts within countries. In other words, civil wars. So the good news is that countries have largely stopped fighting each other directly. Interstate wars are now extremely rare. Great powers haven't fought each other directly since Korea. Why is this? Well, a few different reasons. Memories of the world wars, you know, never again. Nuclear deterrence, the spread of democracy, institutions like the UN, international trade, have all had a pacifying effect on the relations between countries. The bad news, however, is that civil wars still exist. In other words, terrorists and insurgents didn't get the memo that war was over. Nuclear weapons and democracy can stop conflicts between countries, but they can't stop our countries from disintegrating into ethnic or sectarian violence. Meanwhile, the causes of civil war haven't gone anywhere, whether it's poverty, failing governance, or ethno-religious tension. So if you look around the world today, about 90% of wars are civil wars, including every conflict you can think of: Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, etc. For the United States, foreign civil wars have become a major security issue, causing humanitarian crises, refugee flows, and terrorism. In fact, for the last 25 years, arguably America has been threatened less by strong states than by collapsing states. And crucially, civil wars have become the arena for interstate military competition. What I mean by that is that countries don't invade each other directly, but they do compete with each other by meddling in civil wars through proxy conflicts, by backing different factions with arms or self-defense forces or air power in Ukraine or in particular in Syria, also in Yemen and Libya. So what was the result of this shift after 1945 from classic conventional interstate war to civil war and guerrilla fighting? Well, for the United States, it created an era of unwinnable conflict. So why is this? Why is it that the United States has struggled for all of its vast power in this new era of civil war? Well, let me explain a few reasons. First of all, Washington ended up intervening in distant and culturally alien countries that it didn't understand. So in places like Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, we are strangers in a strange land. We don't comprehend the geography, the religion, the traditions, the ethnic politics, or the languages. Let me just give you a piece of evidence that illustrates this. In 2006, at the height of the Iraq War, there were 1,000 American officials working in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Of those 1,000, 6 spoke Arabic. But we also tend to have a lot of illusions about foreign countries that we don't understand. Americans believe that if you scratch a foreigner, there is an American trying to get out. In other words, America is the natural condition. And foreigners are unlucky enough to have a tyrant repressing their natural Americanism. If you simply remove the tyrant, then Afghans or Iraqis or Kosovo Albanians or Libyans or whoever can assume their natural life as Americans. This, of course, is completely wrong. There's a second problem. For a global hegemon like the United States, every war that we fight is just one of many competing security commitments around the world, right? In other words, we're juggling Afghanistan with Iraq and many other challenges. But for the enemy, the conflict is a life and death contest that occupies its entire attention. It is limited war for us. It is total war for them. We have more power. They have more willpower. In Afghanistan, we have the watches. The Taliban has the time. A third point, the U.S. military has also struggled to adapt to this new era of civil wars and guerrilla fighting. So up until 1945, the U.S. routinely crushed enemy countries in wartime with a combination of high explosives, technology, big unit warfare. We basically outproduced any enemy that came along. So naturally, when we faced insurgents after 1945, we tried the same tactics. In Vietnam, for instance, there were free fire zones and enemy kill counts. William Westmoreland, the U.S. commander in Vietnam, was once asked, what is his solution to the insurgency? He gave a one-word answer, quote, firepower. But these tactics proved disastrous in the era of civil wars, where indiscriminate firepower simply causes collateral damage, loses hearts and minds, and recruits more insurgents. A study was done, a fascinating study, of Vietnam and U.S. bombing in Vietnam. And that study found that areas that the U.S. bombed tended to then turn over to the control of the Viet Cong insurgents. Even today, the U.S. military is averse to nation-building, counterinsurgency. It continues to see its core mission as preparing for conventional interstate war, even though these kinds of conflicts are extremely rare. So the military would rather not deal with stabilization operations or would like to sort of get rid of the bad guys and then quickly hand over the mission to other agencies or international organizations. We would like to cook the dinner and have somebody else wash the dishes afterward. But this encourages a short-term vision of war, where we kill the bad guys and then we just go home and that's the end of the war. But what we have found is that this is the mission accomplished trap. Declaring victory prematurely, ignoring the power vacuum that opens up, and that this is a model of war that has failed repeatedly in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Fourth problem, when we go to war, the United States, which is a very idealistic society, often goes to war with a crusading fervor in which we see the fight as a noble battle against evil. And this means that we often miss opportunities to reach out to opponents and negotiate with them. There is a deeply ingrained skepticism in the United States about bargaining with evil enemies. You see that, for example, with opposition to negotiating with Iran and the Iran nuclear deal, which, by the way, was not at all controversial among the Europeans who also negotiated it, but is controversial in the US. Why is this? Why don't we like negotiating with bad guys? Well, partly it's American power, so Americans think we don't need to. And partly it is the moralistic strain in American society, which means that we think we are sullying our deepest values by talking to these guys. The danger is that we miss opportunities to reach out at critical moments in these wars. So in Afghanistan, the time to talk to the Taliban was in 2002. That was the time when they were on the run and they might have been willing to make a deal to have a place on the new Afghanistan. But we waited 10 years to start negotiations with the Taliban, by which time it was a very different war. Or think about Iraq. In 2003, right at the start of the Iraq War, just as the insurgency was beginning, Paul Wolfowitz in the administration, Deputy Secretary of Defense, received a memo. And the memo suggested that the U.S. reach out to the Sunni insurgents before this got out of control. Well, Wolfowitz wrote three words in the margin of the memo. And those words were, quote, "they are Nazis." In other words, there's no reason we should negotiate. We missed a critical opportunity. Fifth and final problem is that the United States has struggled to adapt to this new era of war, but our enemies have adapted. Right? Guerrillas have raised their game, forming networks. For example, the Taliban has exchanged notes with Iraqi insurgents on improvised explosive devices. If you look around the world, what's interesting is not every country has struggled in this era of civil wars. Russia, for example, has had far greater success in manipulating civil wars in places like Ukraine, Syria, Georgia. Iran has also had some considerable success in Iraq and Syria. So why is this? Well, they have far less power than the United States, but they also tend to intervene in countries where they have networks and knowledge, places like Iraq for Iran or Ukraine for Russia. They don't send forces to the far side of the world, which is the US way. They also intervene in places where their core interests are at stake, like Iran in Iraq, which means they have much more of a long-term commitment. And their militaries are more willing to adapt to the era of civil wars. Iran, for example, its entire military is based on unconventional fighting and allying with militias and non-state actors, and it's very comfortable in this type of world of civil wars. So I just want to turn now to, having sort of set the stage a little bit in the context of America's experience of war, to thinking about politics today and the Trump administration. So how does Trump connect to this? Well, let me just give you a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, who traveled around the United States, as you probably know, in the 1830s and wrote the famous book, Democracy in America. He said, quote, "On my arrival in the United States, I was surprised to find so much distinguished talent among the subjects and so little among the heads of the government." So will Trump return the U.S. to the path of victory that we seem to have left in 1945? Well, he's certainly obsessed with winning. And he has noted this unfortunate military record. Trump said, quote, "We have to start winning wars again." He said, "When I was young, in high school and college, everybody used to say we never lost a war. We never lost a war. And now we never win a war." So he's recognized this. He doesn't really have a coherent foreign policy ideology, but he does have some consistent beliefs that allies take advantage of the United States, that global trade disadvantages the US, immigration is bad, as well as a sympathy for authoritarians. And these beliefs are actually pretty deeply felt. Some of you may not know, but back in 1987, Trump actually paid for a full-page ad in the New York Times that cost him $100,000 at the time, in which he basically attacked America's allies for free riding and taking advantage of the US. similar themes to which he's put forward today. I think Trump wouldn't want to give the New York Times $100,000 today. So what then about war? Well, in fairness, Trump has recognized the dangers of regime change and the unintended consequences that can happen. He has also, in fairness, sustained and reinforced Obama's basic approach against ISIS, building up partners, supporting them with air power, special forces, and pushing ISIS back is probably the biggest foreign policy success we've had, although it's interestingly the one where we've had the most continuity with the Obama administration. But there are also some big dangers that I want to touch on with the Trump administration in this context of America's broader challenges fighting in civil wars. So the first thing we see from opinion polls is that there has been a collapse in global views of American leadership. Polls suggest more people around the world approve of China's leadership than the United States. Ironically, the country that has the highest disapproval of the Trump administration, with 83%, is Norway. Now, some of you may remember it was Norwegians that Trump thought were the preferred source of immigration. You might rethink when he looks at the numbers. So does this matter? I think it does for at least a couple reasons. We should show a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. For one thing, if very large numbers of countries agree on something, they're very often right. So if 195 countries agree to the Paris climate change framework, they're probably onto something. But the second issue is that in these complex civil wars, we need allies to voluntarily support the US in order to achieve success. You can't fight the war on terror alone. And a particular danger with Trump is what I call his kinetic vision of war. So what I mean by this is that Trump tends to see war in terms of battle, in terms of firepower, in terms of destruction, as opposed to Clausewitz's famous view of war, that it is an extension of politics. And you should always see war as a form of politics. It's not about destroying things, it's about the political consequences. So if you look at Trump's proposed budget, he wants to pour money into big ticket hardware like aircraft carriers that look good and are useful for fighting other countries, but not necessarily useful in civil wars. He also has described war in apolitical terms, in terms of destroying enemies, wiping radical Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth. He's talked about loosening the rules of engagement, being less squeamish about killing civilians. He even talked about reintroducing torture or killing the family members of terrorists. All of which might be effective in the immediate term, but will have negative political consequences. At the same time, if you remember, I said the US military is sort of averse to nation building. Well, the Trump administration is strongly against anything that even hints at nation building. They want to cut spending on the State Department, peacekeeping, foreign aid. And Rex Tillerson said, quote, the Secretary of State, "We are not in the business of nation building or reconstruction." Is it going to work? Is this approach to war going to work? No, I fear that it is doubling down on the errors of the past. The story of the last 70 years is that American military might does not translate into victory on the battlefield. Because in modern wars, victory is not about who has the biggest guns, but who can gain legitimacy in terms of popular support. And this kinetic view that war is about just killing bad guys creates this short-term vision. And we see that today where we have pushed ISIS back. But the fall of Raqqa, the ISIS capital, is not the end of the movie, right? We are not even halfway through the movie. We have to think about the next steps. What does the post-caliphate look like? How do we stop an ISIS resurgence? How do we stop open conflict between Turkey and the Syrian Kurds, who, by the way, both happen to be American allies? So there's a huge danger here. I just want to make two final points. The first is, how can we return to the path of winning? How can we turn around this record of failed wars? Well, I suggest that we try to make war safe, legal, and rare. So what I mean by that is, first of all, safe. We need to train the military for the kind of wars that we're actually going to face. No one particularly is enthusiastic about nation building, But in a world where 90% of wars are civil wars, we are going to be involved in some kind of stabilization operation, whether we're on a humanitarian mission or fighting terrorists or whatever. So that means preparing soldiers for the human dimension of war with more cultural training, more language training, and strengthening our capacity to advise indigenous forces. The problem is that American society more broadly, the U.S. military in particular, just doesn't see the U.S. mission as nation building. It sees American soldiers as warriors, and their job is to fight enemy countries. So for instance, at the height of the Iraq War, the U.S. set up the Irregular Warfare Center, which was designed to basically train American soldiers in the lessons that we'd learned from Iraq and Afghanistan about counterinsurgency, a very valuable mission. In 2014, they shut the center down, even though 90% of wars are irregular wars. So we need to be prepared for war. We need war to be legal, which means fighting according to the rules. In these complex civil wars, we need multilateral support. We need to fight by upholding the rule of law on the battlefield. We need congressional buy-in, and so on. And then rare means fighting fewer wars. So the United States goes to war too readily. And one way I think we could overcome this is to force U.S. officials to imagine how they will exit from the war if things go wrong before we ever go to war. So to give you an analogy, before you head to Las Vegas for a quick fire wedding, I would suggest you spend some time sitting in the divorce courts and just watching the marital exit strategies unfold. It might make you think twice about whether you really want to marry this person you don't know in Las Vegas. And in the same vein, having officials think through how they will get out of the country if it all unravels might make them think twice about going to war. Final point. Do we have the unity in America to face these challenges? So if you look around the world, you see these complex civil wars in places from Ukraine to Syria. Now look at the United States. Look at places like Ferguson, Baltimore, and elsewhere. You see echoes of foreign conflicts with political, economic, racial division here in the United States. It was Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, who talked about the police in certain communities as, quote, an occupying force. It was the New York Police Union that said that the cops had a, quote, wartime mentality. We see the militarization of the police, who often inherit military gear, widespread distrust of government. Political division and partisanship are sapping America's ability to face big challenges abroad. If you'd asked me a few years ago what was the biggest issue facing the U.S., I would have said handling the rise of China, climate change, these kind of issues. Today, I would say it is division in the United States. That is the number one problem. The war has come home. Or perhaps the war was already here. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dominic. Very thought-provoking. And I think your initial comment that Americans don't like to hear this is truly a great one. So with that in mind, while we're collecting some questions from the audience, I wanted to use the prerogative of the moderator and ask the first one and push back a little bit on this idea of an expanded role for the military. Is it really true? I always think of the military myself as the people who fight the wars, and the diplomats and other parts of the government as those who do the nation building and diplomacy. Do we need to beef up our military, or do we need to get better coordination between our State Department and our military?
So it's a terrific question, and I would say it's not either or, right? It's both. I think we do need to increase capabilities in the State Department, for example, which have been hollowed out in the last year. A large number of senior figures have left the State Department. These are some of the capabilities that you need when you're dealing with these types of complex civil wars and stabilization missions. But this traditional notion that the U.S. military are warriors, not nation builders, that they destroy enemy countries and then go home, is, I'm afraid, an anachronistic model of war. The U.S. soldier's job is not to fight conventional interstate war. The U.S. soldier's job is to protect America. And in certain eras, that will require your classic conventional interstate war, like World War II or even the Gulf War. But in eras where almost all conflicts are civil wars, the U.S. military will need to broaden its mission statement and become more skilled at these wider activities. After all, the key point is that there is no alternative to the U.S. military engaging in stabilization, because once you topple a regime in somewhere like Iraq or Afghanistan, who else is going to stabilize the country other than the U.S. military? There is no capability that you just hand over to, and attempts to find that capability and just find local people to sort of take care of things prove catastrophic. So, for example, in Afghanistan in 2001, the Bush administration had absolutely no interest in nation building in Afghanistan. And a year after the U.S. invasion, a year after we toppled the Taliban, there were only 10,000 soldiers, American soldiers, in the whole country. And they were engaged on a narrow counterterrorism mission because of this philosophy that we're not in the nation-building business. Well, what was the result? The Taliban, which had fled south, regrouped, and the insurgency began, and here we are 17 years later fighting them. So given the kind of global context we see, given American interests, I really see no alternative to the U.S. military broadening its vision and its capabilities.
Here's another question that came in from our audience here that kind of is, in my view, a follow-up. You said America's military isn't prepared to win the wars we've been fighting, these civil wars, but hasn't our military strength kept interstate wars from happening? I mean, is there a balance here that we need to...
No, absolutely. And, of course, you wouldn't want to lurch entirely to the other end of the scale, right? You wouldn't want to, you know, give up all of America's capabilities at interstate war. That would be reckless. And I think the U.S. has played a key role in helping to stabilize relations between countries, partly because it set up many of the institutions like the UN, partly because the U.S. Navy is the guarantor of globalization and international trade. So you do need that capability. But after decades and decades of investing hundreds of billions of dollars in this high-tech, big-ticket hardware, the U.S. is at no risk of losing its edge at interstate war. No risk whatsoever. It is, however, at a very obvious risk of being unable to handle these civil wars. And one reason for this is that there is a very powerful bias in terms of military spending. And you could call this the military-industrial complex. Right? There's an enormous amount of money to be made by building things like F-35 warplanes. The F-35 is the most expensive defense project in the history of the world, at $1 trillion. But the beneficiaries are spread out throughout the United States. So the whole plane is not made in a single state, right? Everybody gets a little piece of the action. And so a lot of congressmen, a lot of senators have an incentive to turn the other cheek or ignore what's going on and the kind of waste that we see there. But when you look at something like language training or cultural training, there is no language training industrial complex, right, to push back the other way. And so there's a lot of biases in the system that I think really encourage us to spend billions and billions and billions on, you know, nuclear attack submarines and further aircraft carriers and more F-35s. And we might already have enough of some of those capabilities when we are really, really struggling and thousands of Americans are dying in civil war battlefields that we're not ready for.
And then I promise I'll only do one more question in this general area, but the question here is, what are the best diplomatic tools to preclude war in this era? I.e., what is the role of diplomacy in times of these conflicts?
Diplomacy is absolutely critical. The real challenge with hollowing out America's diplomatic capabilities is that you may not know what you're missing until it's too late, right? In other words, diplomacy and its benefits can sometimes be hidden in the immediate term. State Department officials in Greece or Syria or Afghanistan or wherever are building relationships, right, day in, day out. And you might not see the payoff from that immediately. But a few months later, a few years later, you might need to turn to those relationships when a crisis strikes. And the crises often hit in unexpected places. In 2001, there was a meeting at the Pentagon. A major American general said to the group, he said, we need in the United States, so this was before 9/11, he said, we need to be ready to fight anywhere in the world. He said, the only country that I know we'll never fight in is Afghanistan. So you never know where the crisis is going to come. You need to have these capabilities, and the payoff is long term. And in terms of going to war, we just need to be much more choosy about starting these conflicts. But the problem is, the more power you have as a country, the more tempting it is to use that power. The writer Robert Kagan has a lovely analogy where he says, if you live in a hut, this works very well in Maine actually, if you live in a hut and there's a bear outside, right? If your weapon is a knife, you decide you can live with the bear. But he says, if your weapon is a shotgun, suddenly you can't live with the bear, right? So capability shapes your desire to take on threats. And replace that bear hut analogy with, say, Saddam Hussein. The Europeans are weak, so they can live with Saddam. We're strong, so we decide to take him out. But the power is a temptation that can lead you down a road that you don't expect. Every recent major American war evolved in ways we did not predict.
When you present your thesis to the military intelligentsia, the leaders in the military, I'm sure, are familiar, what are their concerns? Why do they say they don't want to go down this path?
So let me tell you a story that illustrates this quite nicely. A couple years ago, I was invited to go to Germany to talk to the senior leadership of NATO, including the Supreme Allied Commander and various other dignitaries. And I thought, as I was preparing my lecture, I thought, okay, do I play it safe? You know, I can tell them how great NATO is and how important it is as an alliance, and everything will be hunky-dory. I thought, well, it's rare that you get an opportunity to talk to this kind of really distinguished group of senior generals. And I thought, I've got to press a few buttons. So I came and gave my remarks, and a large part of it was about how the U.S. military needs to broaden its thinking away from traditional interstate war. And although we don't want to get involved in counterinsurgency, we don't really want to do nation building, it's inevitable we're going to do it in some way, and we should be ready for it and trained for it. So I gave these remarks, and afterwards I sat down at the table with the generals for a kind of little debrief seminar. And the first person to ask a question was this 3- or 4-star Marine general from Texas. And it's a pretty big guy, pretty intimidating Texan. I'm going to try and replicate his accent now, which is extremely risky. He asked the first question. He leans back in his chair, and this is what he said. He said, Dominic, he said, I disagree with just about every single thing you said. So I thought, okay, great. this has gone well. But we actually had a very interesting discussion. And although some of the folks around the table pushed back, others were more open to this sort of broader view of the war, is this deeply entrenched culture in the U.S. military that their mission, as they see it, this is the phrase they use, their mission is to fight and win the nation's wars. Okay, that's their mission statement, fight and win the nation's wars. And what they mean by that are interstate wars, right? So tank battles, artillery duels, F-35 plane battles, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, fighting and winning the nation's wars is not about destroying enemy tanks. It is about consolidated political success, right? And I think the military is more open to this. You have people like David Petraeus, for example, who's very much aware of this. But you also see this very, very strong traditionalist view that says, they look at Iraq and Afghanistan, and the lesson they take is not, let's get better at nation building. The lesson they take is, let's never do this again. So after the Vietnam War, a very similar thing happened where the U.S. military sort of rebelled against the whole notion of counterinsurgency. The American army after Vietnam actually destroyed its material on counterinsurgency. Material that it had, knowledge that it had gained at an extraordinary price in American lives. It destroyed it. Why did it destroy it? Because if it couldn't do counterinsurgency, it would never be asked to do it again. But of course, what's happened is we can't really do it, and we have been asked to do it again. So I fear that there'll be a repeat of that in the wake of Iraq.
We have several here on kind of the political motivations for getting into these conflicts. One is, what do you see as the political motivation of engaging in civil wars or proxy wars is a primary motivation, the need for an enemy. One that's related here is the inclination to intervene in foreign civil wars a red versus blue issue? So the politics again. And finally, have there been any civil wars that the great powers have been able to stay out of? And then why?
That's a great question. There's no very simple answer to why countries, including the United States, get involved. There can be all kinds of motivations. Humanitarian motivations, right? Think about the Libyan intervention in 2011. Obama didn't want another war in the Middle East, but felt he had to act to stop what he thought would be a massacre in Benghazi by Gaddafi's forces. Or going further back, Somalia in 1992, humanitarian mission. Alternatively, counterterrorism can draw the U.S. into these conflicts. In obviously, after 9/11 would be a great example, but Iraq and Syria more recently with the emergence of ISIS. So there's a wide variety of security threats, moral or humanitarian rationales. Essentially, in the modern era, almost all roads lead to engagement in these civil wars because these are the only wars that are happening. Has the United States kept out of any of these wars? Yes, there are many wars that are sort of not on the radar. Democratic Republic of the Congo. Right, how many people know that there was a war in the Congo in the late 90s and early 2000s in which 5 million people died? Right, never registered at all. Why? Because Al-Qaeda was not there and because we don't care as much, frankly, about what happens in much of Africa. That may change because of increasing security interests and investment in Africa and so on, but that has traditionally been the case. So there are plenty of tough civil wars where the sort of are not on the media radar and don't feature, but there are also plenty of examples of intervention and foreign meddling.
You know, as you said to begin with, some of these messages are hard for us to take. So here's a question. Re the willingness to negotiate. Could early negotiations with Hitler have changed the trajectory of Europe? Was Chamberlain onto something?
You probably saw that Gary Oldman won the Oscar as a heavily made-up but still mightily impressive Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. And we seem to have a glut of these movies about that little period of the Dunkirk period in 1940 where Halifax, Lord Halifax and other British officials said we should negotiate with Hitler, and Churchill said let's fight them on the beaches and said this is our finest hour. The problem, by the way, with saying that 1940 was Britain's finest hour is that everything since then has been a bit of a letdown. But that's just sort of a side note. So it is a classic question that is, who can you negotiate with and when? And what I would say is there are adversaries that you just simply cannot negotiate with. The Nazis are probably one of them, right? Committed to aggression and willing to break any agreements that they sign, I think they just simply had to be defeated. ISIS may well be another candidate that you simply cannot negotiate with ISIS. They are too extreme, too committed to their ideology. But the truth is that you can negotiate with the vast majority of actors that the United States engages with. Indeed, the story of these wars is that we do negotiate with these enemies. It's just very late in the day. So we had peace negotiations in Vietnam for 5 years, 1968 to 1973. Why didn't we start earlier, right? We have been talking to the Taliban off and on. There was a prisoner exchange, for example, with Bo Bergdahl. But those talks began in 2011. That's 10 years after the war began. And in Iraq, we also reached out to Sunni insurgents in what was called the awakening movement or the surge phase in Iraq. But again, that was in late 2006, 2007, years after the war had begun, by which time thousands of Americans were dead and many tens of thousands of Iraqis were dead. So the pattern here is that when the war unravels, we eventually realize we have to negotiate with these people we don't particularly like. The time to talk was much earlier, when the United States had greater leverage. Again, Once you see war not in terms of good versus evil or in terms of blowing up the bad guys, but instead as a political process where you are trying to achieve political goals, then negotiation becomes an inherent part of the process, right? You can fight and talk at the same time, right? Since the whole endeavor is about politics.
And while we're talking about dictators and whether they're possible to negotiate with them, let's talk a little bit about North Korea. How would a war with North Korea be won, but are we possibly on the precipice of a new interstate war between the U.S. and North Korea? And should we be negotiating?
So I think that actually the odds of war with North Korea are very low, but not low enough. So they're very low in part because relations between countries around the world are stable, and one of the reasons for that is nuclear deterrence. No two countries with nuclear weapons have ever gone to war with each other, right? And there's an obvious reason for that. Nuclear weapons make leaders wary and cautious. And the North Korean regime may be utterly brutal, but it is focused first and foremost on regime survival. And it does not want to lose a war. It does not want to fight the United States. Now, a war could still happen, in part because of the chance of misperception. I don't think we understand what's going on in Pyongyang. I don't think the North Koreans understand the U.S. I mean, what they make of Trump through their lens is it must just be extraordinary. The solution is to contain and deter North Korea. Now, this is not a satisfactory solution, right? I would love to see North Korea rid of its nuclear program. As an expert on nonproliferation, I'm sure would agree. But it's just not going to happen. North Korea is not going to give up this program that it's invested so many resources in and is such a signal of the pride and of the nation and of the regime. So it's not going to happen. So we can adopt, however, tools of containment and of deterrence to restrict the damage North Korea is able to do, maintain a broad international alliance directed against North Korea, and then hopefully prepare for the day when the regime crumbles and we can see freedom finally arrive in North Korea.
And we have a lot of people concerned about what we do once we're into the situation. Let me just read the three questions here. The first Gulf War was essentially a punitive expedition with no nation-building follow-up. Is this a better model? Second one, given that we are in Iraq and Afghanistan for the wrong reasons, is it better for us just to run or stay? Then what, if anything, should be our plan in Syria?
The Gulf War was a success, and President George H.W. Bush made a very wise choice in the Gulf War back in 1991, which was not to march on Baghdad. So the U.S. routed the Iraqi forces, liberated Kuwait, and then made a decision not to march on Baghdad. And why was this wise? Well, because of course, we would have been left running the country. The U.S.-led coalition would also have collapsed because a lot of allies did not support marching on Baghdad. And in fact, overthrowing Saddam in 1991 would have been illegal because the U.N. resolution did not cover an invasion of Iraq. It's interesting, therefore, when you look at opinion polling in the midst of the Gulf War, to find far more than 70% of Americans supporting marching on Baghdad and overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Because of this vision of war where you have the bad guy, the tyrant, the dictator, and this view that war must end with the dictator being toppled. That's the appropriate end of war, and then we go home, right? Sort of like a World War II, get rid of the dictator, they sign a surrender document in Tokyo Harbor, and then sort of we go home. And that was what I think a lot of Americans wanted in 1991, and Bush resisted that and showed restraint in the war aims, and I think that was in America's strategic interest. So I don't think it's a model for all wars, but it is an example of the power of restraint and keeping focused on minimal goals. Should we run or stay? Well, in these complex civil wars, there is no simple template, you know, run, stay. What you have to do is carefully assess your interests, carefully assess what capabilities you have, and employ the means in an efficient way to achieve your goals. So I think that the U.S. contribution to the war against ISIS was appropriate. It's just now we need to prepare for the next phase and stopping ISIS from reemerging in some way, shape, or form. After all, ISIS's predecessor was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they were basically crushed during the surge awakening phase in 2007. And then they went underground and then reemerged later on as a much more powerful force, ISIS. So there is a model that ISIS is going to try to copy, and we may need to make sure that the playbook isn't followed and history doesn't repeat itself. So it's, again, this long-term vision where the fall of Raqqa is not like the defeat of Nazi Germany and we go home, the movie is over and the credits come on. We now move on to the next chapter of this war. I don't want to see endless war. I'd love to see the U.S. decreasing its commitment in the Middle East. But we can't simply walk away from the ruins and call it victory.
So while I was in Syria, there are some people concerned about the Kurds and with our record of walking away from those who have helped us. Trump seems to be abandoning the Kurds just as Russia, Turk, Syria are uniting against them. What is the solution?
Yeah, this is a very difficult issue. You know, the Kurds are in many ways the good guys, right? I mean, I don't want to reduce this to good guys and bad guys, right? That's the whole point is to avoid that. But it's easy to sort of see the Kurds as the good guys, relatively democratic. You know, the Syrian Kurds have huge numbers of women fighting and are very progressive in many ways. But the broader geopolitical picture is very dangerous here, where Turkey sees the Syrian Kurds as almost an existential threat because it sees them as an extension of Kurdish terrorists. Inside Turkey. And a number of regional players, of course, fear the creation of a Kurdish homeland that could rip their countries to pieces. Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and even Iran all have Kurdish minorities. So for many years, the Kurds have been at the mercy of great power politics, their rise and fall being dictated by decisions made in capitals elsewhere. So what should we do in Syria? Well, now that ISIS is pushed back, there may very well be a showdown between Assad's forces and the Syrian Kurds, in which Assad seeks to essentially crush the Syrian Kurds. What do we do? Ambassador Ford wrote a piece a couple months ago in Foreign Affairs saying, we just need to be pragmatic and stay out of that fight. I would say that goes a little too far. I don't want to get involved in a war for the Syrian Kurds, especially against, you know, a NATO ally like Turkey, and there's no appetite for sending large numbers of American troops to fight for the Syrian Kurds. At the same time, I would like to see the United States use all available capabilities to try to prevent Assad or the Turks from utterly crushing the Syrian Kurds who have been our allies against ISIS. And there's some hope here. Russia, for example, actually has fairly good relations with the Syrian Kurds and has talked about some sort of autonomy and self-government. So in the spirit of pragmatism, and we need to be nothing if not pragmatic in a situation like this, I would hope to deal with at least the Russians and try to create some sort of deal that protects the Syrian Kurds, even if they don't get bona fide autonomy, some sort of self-government. But it's immensely complex. And the problem is that American capabilities are so limited. You know, we couldn't hold Iraq together when we had 150,000 American soldiers in Iraq. Well, how are we going to deal with these issues when there are 2,000 American soldiers in Syria?
And I want to get a couple more questions in before we quit. One, and there's three versions of it here, but it goes back to our motivations and the internal politics, really, of getting into these type of conflicts. And they all relate to the draft. What about reintroducing conscription? What change would be brought back if we bring back the draft, and do we need a draft?
So it's a great question. I have to say there is a real logic to the view that the problem is that we don't have a draft, and that if you have this professional military, which, by the way, is increasingly divorced from mainstream society, or at least from, say, the liberal side of the aisle, so to speak, and is part of the broader polarization of American society. If you have this professional military, then it's easy just to send it off into these foreign wars. And if you had a draft, and in particular if the sons and daughters of America's elite were serving, then there would be greater resistance, greater thought about whether to go to war. So there is a real logic to this, but I actually just don't buy it. And the reason I don't buy it is one word, Vietnam. It was a draft. And the United States still engaged in Vietnam. So I'm not sure that that tactic alone or that tool would actually necessarily stop the U.S. from intervening in these various conflicts that we don't fully understand. It didn't in the past. and I'm not sure it would in the future. And also, I think that a draft is impedes on people's liberty and would have a lot of negative consequences for ordinary Americans.
Then let me end with an entirely different question related to the fact that you're a professor and interact with younger people. Given the political environment, are your students interested in entering politics or the State Department, or has this, all of this driven them all away?
So I'm lucky enough to teach a terrific group of students at Swarthmore, and many of them are interested in working for the State Department, serving the country in various ways. Teaching them and talking to them actually gives you a great deal of hope that America, for all of its problems in facing these civil wars and for all of the domestic division in the United States, truth is that America has an enormous number of assets. I don't just mean its military capabilities. I mean its terrific universities, its very strong economy, its size, right, its democratic traditions. There are some pretty powerful assets that I think will ultimately help the United States come out of this era and hopefully limit the damage. I would, however, add, though, that an interesting thing I've observed is that at the moment, the students are quite focused on domestic issues. The pendulum has kind of swung a little bit. When I first arrived at Swarthmore, there was huge interest in stopping genocide in Darfur and if necessary, you know, send in the Marines and fight, you know, right wrongs around the world, a kind of missionary view, liberal interventionism. That is gone. And it has gone in large part because of Iraq and Afghanistan, which has led many young students to think that, rightly or wrongly, there's not much we can do to help these people, and anything we do is probably going to backfire, so let's keep out of it. So I rarely see, you know, student groups talking about Syria. They talk about it academically in the classroom, but they're not mobilized on Syria. The issues that they are passionate about are domestic issues, Trump, right, inequality, and also a lot of identity politics issues are really at the fore today. But I think that pendulum will swing, and at some point in the near future, the passion for, you know, global engagement and so on will reemerge, for better or for worse, because it comes with some challenges as well as opportunities.
Well, thank you very, very much.